The Guardian.
Hi, everybody. This is Max here. I hope you're looking forward to today's podcast. Just a note to say, it's really long, but it didn't feel long. So hopefully you're entertained by all of it. If you hate it at any point, you're allowed to pause it and come back to it at a later time. Otherwise, have a really great day. Thanks. Do you want to say anything, Jay?
No,
not
today.
Okay, thanks.
Hello, welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. Today, the weekend's games lead to some questions no one has ever asked before. How good are Manchester City? When should we start giving Manchester United the same amount of credit? Harry Kane, is he world class? Has Arsene Wenger turned the corner? And why didn't Ronald Koeman buy a striker? Plus, politics with Sid as Barcelona play behind closed doors and Piqué's international futures in the balance. All that, a few questions, a tiny feedback corner, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a panel. Everyone's favourite Irish Scandinavian, Lars Sivertsen, is here. How are you, Lars?
I'm good, Max. I had a really eye-opening experience on the train the other day.
Oh, good.
Because I've been living in England for like 5-6 years now, and I was on a train, and quite a large man stepped on my toe, and I immediately apologised to him. And it was sort of a moment that made me realise I am now fully integrated into English society. You know?
So Irish, British, Scandinavian?
I think so.
Okay, fine. Everyone's favourite Irishman, Barry Glendening, is here.
Hello.
How are you?
Well, I'm very well, thank you.
Good. And everyone's favourite, Jackie Oatley. Jackie Oatley is here. How are you?
Hello, very well, thank you.
A slight disclaimer to the panel. I'm a little bit worse for wear. If you could carry me through, as you have many times before, I would appreciate it greatly.
Why are you slightly worse?
I was out at a golf weekend, not a charity one, with Z-listers, Barry, with some real friends.
Okay.
Yeah. Chelsea 0, Manchester City 1. Really, it could have been a lot more than that, couldn't it, Jackie Oatley? I thought Manchester City was superb.
I'm so happy. I'm so happy. Which is basically the post-match interview of Pep Guardiola after that game, because I think he was so happy.
I thought you were doing a Sven Göran Eriksson, and I was trying to work out how that fitted in.
No,
that's full Pep.
Why have you been thinking about Sven?
I don't know. That's just what it sounded like.
Right.
Remember, I'm a bit sleepy.
But impressions, even. Yes, he has reasons to be absolutely delirious, because going to one of your top rivals, the defending champions, and convincingly beating them. Yes, it was only 1-0, but of course they were without Aguero, who, well, we know what happened to him and his ribs late at night in Amsterdam, and effectively not missing him, and also having the player who was effectively rejected by Chelsea scoring the winner. It was all a bit of a perfect outcome for Manchester City. And I think for Pep in particular, it was a case of his ideas coming to fruition. And even when they did miss Guardiola and they did not have a left back through injury, and they had a makeshift one with a midfielder in Fabian Delph there, everything came off for him. Everything he worked on in training came off. And I think for a manager, that is the holy grail, to be doing your post-match interviews talking about everything that you've worked on in training coming to fruition.
Jonathan Wilson, Barry, says this is the first time Guardiola's dominated another elite team in England. Would you go with that?
Oh, I hate when you spring questions like that on me.
You could just say yes, I totally agree.
Yeah, I would agree with Jonathan there. If he says it, it must be true. It was a real statement performance, I thought. You know, as Jackie said, to go into the belly of the beast and perform so well. They really schooled Chelsea. You know, the scoreline flattered Chelsea, if anyone. De Bruyne, Silva, outstanding. Fabian Delph was excellent. You know, his, I think, a career renaissance. It's early days yet, but I'm not sure anyone saw that coming.
I put him in the England squad last week and I was laughed at. And then he got in the England squad last week, proving...
It doesn't take too much to get in the England squad these days. I'm not being horrible, but even Gareth Southgate agrees.
But it's quite interesting, isn't it, that sort of fullback thing that Pep does, where they are fullback and then they're not there anymore, but it doesn't matter that they're not where they're meant to be, they're attacking.
Well, I think they didn't play so wide, particularly wide on Saturday. They were tucked in a bit and causing all sorts of bother for Chelsea. They were, and they gave Silva and De Bruyne a lot of freedom to, you know, move forward. City played this ridiculously high line, and it was a sort of a tactical masterclass.
Akshay says, do you think Conte got it wrong tactically against City? Lars?
I mean, I you do wonder if it could have been slightly different if Victor Moses hadn't come off of playing two games in quite a short space of time and could have been on that right flank and tried to push forward a little bit there, because they did quite purposely attack the space between the wing backs and the wide central defenders, which is always a weakness in that sort of three at the back system. There's always a bit of a space there that if you can attack it with wide men like they did with Sterling and Sané, it will make life a little bit awkward. But it is really hard to stop that sort of, when Pep Guardiola's teams get into this way of playing, of dominating possession like they do, of keeping it that well, it's a hard thing to play against. And I agree, it felt like a bit of a landmark performance because it's taken time, because it's not an easy way to play football and it takes a long time to get those ideas across to the players. It's really fascinating. You can read up on the sort of intricate training methods of Pep Guardiola and how he separates the pitch into 20 different zones and everyone has to know what to do when the ball are in the different zones and all that. I mean, this takes
a long...
Does
he name the zones?
Like, I'm sure.
Like, the Crystal Maze, the Aztec
exactly.
one.
So you can understand that it's not easy to go into a team, and especially in England where, because of the amount of games, you don't actually have that much time on the training ground to actually make them understand all this. And it's probably taken him more than a year and a bit of a clear out in the summer to get a squad where everyone more or less understands what it is that they're meant to be doing. And you do wonder, it's going to be really hard to stop them now, because when they're able to go away to Chelsea and do that, it's really coming to fruition.
The only thing I'd say, and it's not to take away from what was a very good win, is I think the injury to Alvaro Morata really stymied Chelsea. What was it, after about half an hour? And also, they had a very, very, very grueling game against Atletico Madrid.
When they played brilliantly as well.
Yeah. And I think they maybe were a bit leggy after that, and it's sort of understandable.
Hazard's first start of the season as well.
Yeah, but isn't it a bit weird they didn't bring Batshuayi on when Morata was injured and didn't have any centre-forwards on the pitch?
You'd think so after his goal as well in midweek. You'd think he'd have been up for that. But Willian is a highly talented player, and players, teams, managers don't always choose to put the obvious solution on depending on the way they play. For example, Wolverhampton Wanderers started without a centre-forward and they ended up winning 4-0 at the weekend.
How long did it take her to get that in?
Have we started yet? Hey,
she did sit in the right chair though today, Barry.
Well, yes.
So, you know.
I did hover over your chair just to try to absorb the aura.
The aura of Glendenning.
That's one word for it.
Could Pep turn Delph into the left-footed Philip Lahm?
Well, I mean, we laugh, but I mean, Delph does have quite a few of the qualities that you want for a player in that system, because he's quick. He can move quickly over short distances, and he's quite comfortable on the ball. You know, skillful enough, and he seems to have taken all these complex tactical instructions on board to a great extent. So if you have a guy who can come in and do a decent role and be part of the squad, then that's a really valuable thing to have.
Okay, then. Well, so City have got the title. Manchester United are going to come second then, aren't they? They've scored four or more goals six times so far this season. Under Louis van Gaal, they scored four goals in a game four times in 2 years. It was only Crystal Palace, Barry.
Yes, and, you know, we've said it before, will they ever score again?
Who have they got next? Chelsea, is it?
Yeah.
It's just not fair, is it?
Newcastle away.
Oh, dear.
Roy Hodgson already has the air about him of a man who's realised he's made a terrible, terrible mistake. It was an impressive performance against a terrible, terrible team. There are quite a few very bad teams in the Premier League, and Crystal Palace are considerably worse than most. So I wouldn't go reading too much into it, but as the old saw goes, you can only beat what's put in front of you. And Manchester United did it with a minimum of fuss. But Marouane Fellaini scoring two, that's got to be a worry for Palace as well.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, Fellaini's, he's so interesting. I mean, I don't know if it's just because he's got lots of hair that he stands out from other footballers that are kind of effective but not brilliant at football necessarily. Andy asks, is Fellaini proving that effectiveness is much more valuable to managers than talent? Jackie?
Well, that's a little bit harsh, isn't it? I mean, credit to Jose Mourinho here, because when he came in, he already started talking about Fellaini and giving him a lot of love publicly, because his confidence must have been pretty low, signed by David Moyes, that that's a good reason for that. And he was not loved by the fans. He was seen as this big, useless lump, but actually very effective. And actually, with a lot of love, he has become a key player. And he's scored 3 goals since Pogba's been out. And actually, people aren't talking too much now about how long Pogba's going to be out for, because they're doing just fine without it. They're not missing the injured players, the players they're without, which is really, really handy for them. And everything's looking positive. Fellaini deserves a lot more credit than he gets. But I think people are starting to realise, and it's an alternative option, isn't it? There's more than one way of playing. They play 4-2-3-1 at home, 4-3-3 usually away from home. And he's changed his tactics to suit the match, the opposition, the availability of the players. And Mourinho deserves credit for that.
I think it's also true that if forced to choose between a very tall man and a slightly more talented but slightly smaller man, Jose Mourinho will very often go with the tall man. I think there's no doubt about that. But it also gives you an extra factor that you have a midfielder who can perform a lot of the duties of the midfielder, who can also make runs into the box where he is as dangerous as any, you know, big number nine. That gives you an extra element to your game, which is certainly useful at home against these teams that sit very deep. That's very handy.
Interesting to point out that United haven't played anyone in the top half of the table so far. Their next 4 games, they go to Liverpool and Huddersfield, home to Spurs, away to Chelsea. So that is a tougher set of fixtures than they've had so far. Does anyone have any hope for Crystal Palace? I don't want to find it funny that they haven't scored a goal yet, but you both have your hands up, Jackie and Lars.
I just wanted to throw this out there. I've not thought this through, so this might be stupid, but could there be a positive to having all these impossible games straight away after Hodgson takes over? Because it's kind of a well-known and established fact that it does take a certain amount of time to Hodgsonize a team, to sort of make them play the sort of two banks of four and just get into the positional play and, you know, go full Hodgson. It's not something you can do overnight. So in this period where they probably wouldn't have been fully Hodgson anyway, you get these games where Crystal Palace probably wouldn't been expecting too many points anyway, and by the time the team starts making sense, you have more winnable fixtures on the card.
Yeah, Simon Davis, when Hodgson was at Fulham, said that it took him 2 years to Hodgsonise Fulham. That he's not going to get that long at Palace, but you know, I wouldn't panic yet. Sunderland famously won the championship, having lost the first 6 games of the season. Then Roy Keane came in, marched them out as champions. And that was probably the last time anything good happened at that club.
There was a nice... Sorry, to carry on, Jackie.
I do have some sympathy with Palace players. I know they're getting hammered from all angles for not doing the right things, not being in the right positions, not having the intensity that they ought to have. Understand that. But I bumped into a regular first-teamer outside of football last season, and Sam Allardyce hadn't been there that long, and they're really struggling. They hadn't won yet, and he hadn't had his effect as yet. And I asked him, I said, what is it that's causing all these problems? Why have Palace nosedived? And he said it's because we keep getting different managers coming in and changing our style of play. It's doing our head in. And he said, and Alan Pardew tried to change the style of play but didn't necessarily have the players apart from Johan Cabaye to do that. And it didn't work, and they started sliding down the table, and then various other managers have come in, and now they've got another manager who's come in, and they're trying to change the style of play again. So they do need a period of stability. They need a heck of a lot of time on the training ground, and they need to get a bit of a break. And they could do with some of the best players. I mean, Benteke being out doesn't exactly help them, although he wasn't particularly effective before his injury. They're going to be without Ruben Loftus-Cheek against Chelsea. He's been out as well. And
Zaha has been
out. Zaha, exactly. So
I think he's back soon.
Yeah. And Scott Dan was out as well. So, and also the fact that it only takes one win and suddenly you're in touch with everybody else and people stop talking about not goal scoring. And then other teams can have a crisis of confidence and they might not pick up any points for a few games. So it's far from all over yet.
If any of the three of us guess which player and where you were, will you tell us?
I'd love to tell you where I was.
I'm going.
I don't want that player to get
Scott Dan soft play.
No, I did bump into Gary Cahill at soft play.
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe that's where I got that
goal. Damien Delaney, Funky Butter nightclub.
Yeah, okay.
It wasn't a nightclub.
Okay. But was it Damien Delaney? Well done, Agent Glenn Denning.
No, it wasn't Damien
okay.
Delaney.
Okay. What's your guess? Punching at Wetherspoons.
Yeah. Wilfred Zaha in down the shop. No?
No, it wasn't. Okay. It wasn't down a shop.
Well, if you want to guess below the line, we'll put them all to Jackie next time. We just need Crystal Palace player and location for that game.
I'll tell you afterwards, but not on air, sorry.
Okay. Huddersfield 0, Spurs 4. Now, we discussed last Thursday about how good Harry Kane was. I suspect we could probably do it every pod for the rest of the season. Does anybody have anything to add?
Yeah, why don't we talk about why he's so good?
So
not so much the fact that, he's really
good. I think it's he's deceptively better at every bit of football than people think he is. So he's quicker than you think he is. His first touch is better than you think it is. His finishing is better than you think he is. So you look at him and you don't think, oh, that's Cristiano Ronaldo. But actually, deceptively, he's got every single skill.
I think it's partly that, but I think it's all those things. He's better than he was rather than you think he is, because we can see what he is now. But I was looking back at pictures of him when he was on loan at Leighton Orient, and he was a...
What a life you lead.
Well, do you know, I do. You were having a nice night out in Derbyshire with your mates, and I was in Google imaging pictures of Harry Kane in a Leighton Orient shirt to see how he's changed since he was 17. And he was a cute little chubster. He didn't have any of the upper body strength that he has now. I was also reading interviews with people he used to play with and he was coached by, and they said he always had absolutely the perfect attitude. He wasn't one of these Johnny-come-latelys, I'm from a big club, I'm coming down to the lower leagues and I'm expecting to play every week. His focus was entirely on, I want to get better, I want to know what it's like to play in the lower leagues, I want to get roughed up by defenders and learn and learn and learn. And some of the Tottenham backroom staff deserve credit for the way they've worked on him and his fitness in the gym, because that is a huge amount of it. And I remember seeing him playing for Millwall at the Den a few years back and just thinking, he looked as though he was running in treacle. He was so, not so much slow, but he didn't have any kind of burst of pace then. And I think obviously confidence has helped that, but certainly the gym work that he's done so that he's fitter, faster, stronger.
Dele Alli's dive, we have been accused on previous pods of ignoring English players diving. Should we ignore this one, or does anybody want to have a big go at Dele Alli for diving, which he shouldn't be doing?
Well, yeah, he shouldn't be doing it. It's cheating, and, you know, he got caught and punished, but he's far from the only player who does it. And there's not really much point in singling him out.
I do think sometimes the moral panic over diving sort of outweighs the severity of the offence. That's just my personal opinion. But more in this case, it's just the abject stupidity of this dive, because you're, what, 3-0 up against Huddersfield? Like, this is the time when I need to really cheat to get a penalty. Like, what are you thinking? And Dele Alli is going to have a very long Premier League career, and he's going to get fouled in the box a lot of times. And I think it would be very unsmart for him to get a reputation right now for being a cheat, because I think he'll end up finding that a lot of referees will give the benefit of the doubt the other way. And I think in the long run, that would be unproductive for him.
If he had been sent off, not that there was any, I don't think there was any particular reason for him to get sent off, but had he been, he would have had the dubious distinction of being simultaneously suspended by the FA, UEFA and FIFA. but it was relentless from Spurs, and away from home, you know, they are, it's the point that's been made before. If they weren't at Wembley, they'd be serious title contenders. And I mean, they still are, even having not won a home league game this season.
Yeah, they're at home to Bournemouth next. I'm going to that game. Really looking forward to it as well. And you would think the Harry Kane team, as Pep Guardiola very cheekily described them post-match the other day, said, he says our title rivals are United and the Harry Kane team. But yeah, they obviously have to get that sorted. They haven't won at home yet in the Premier League. But if they can string a run of wins together there, then yes, they're going to become a lot closer than they are now. But I still think it's between the two Manchester sides, realistically.
I do think it's interesting that two of the teams in Europe who are like really punching above their weight and playing really beautiful football in Tottenham and Napoli. Tottenham, I think the Manchester clubs and Chelsea have about twice the wage budget of Tottenham. Juventus have about twice the budget of Napoli. They are two teams who didn't do much in the summer. They're two teams who have looked to continuity and keeping a squad together and developing the way the team works as a group, rather than necessarily throwing money at every single issue, partially because they don't have that much money. And I think it's interesting that seems to be working quite well.
Newcastle-Liverpool. Sorry, Barry.
Before we move on from that game, it's also kind of, I think we Ben Davis deserves a tip of the hat as well. He was outstanding. And that's possibly one of the reasons why Harry Kane is doing so well, because he's got so many assist merchants in that team. They are going to create a lot of chances for him, you know. It was the first big test of Huddersfield's sort of foray into Premier League football as well, and they didn't do very well. I thought they might do better. No shame in losing to Spurs, obviously, but Huddersfield sort of didn't sit back and try and defend, you know, went at them and just got torn apart.
But I think Ben Davies is a great example of that, because I think he's one of several players in this Tottenham team who, over the last few seasons, at various points, people have looked at him and maybe thought, you might not be good enough for a team that's aiming for the top. But instead of sort of binning him off and spending 30 million on a fullback from the French league, Spurs have kind of worked with him and improved his game, presumably, and it's working really well.
They do fullbacks very well at Tottenham, don't they?
They seem to do.
They have spent almost 30 million on a right back from the French league.
That's true.
Haven't they? Anyway.
Who may or may not play many games.
Yes. Newcastle, Liverpool. Sort of some typical Liverpool, score a goal, create loads of chances, don't win. Jackie.
Yeah, 8 goals from 122 shots since that 4-0 win against Arsenal. Only winning 1 in 7 games, Arsenal winning 6 out of 7 in that time, it has to be said. So it was all gone a bit quiet on that front. But he's getting very tetchy, isn't he, Jurgen Klopp? He's getting more and more angry with the media. And of course, it is all our fault for asking him about their side's deficiencies, which mean they've only won 1 of 7 games. It's definitely our fault. And also, I thought it was interesting that that Lovren is playing with a lot of pain at the moment. I think we're going to come on and talk about it later, but he's taking loads of painkillers before his games. And you looked at the defensive calamity, and it was that when Jonjo Shelvey put through that beautiful through ball, and credit to him for it. But really, that shouldn't be happening. If you're a team that wants to be winning the Premier League, you can't have your defenders positioned in such a way that it makes it so easy for the opposition to score.
James Pearce did send that tweet to Dejan Lovren on how he's taking 5 pills to get through every Liverpool game in the Liverpool Echo. Didi Haman quoted the tweet and said, I'm taking 8 pills to be able to watch him every week. Sam Chung says, should Josselu be given goal of the season already? They say the best strikers make finishing look effortless. There was something really glorious about just that, sort of the way it just rolled in, and the happiness for Josselu, because as we've mentioned on this pod before, he's made a habit of side-footing it wide very calmly and casually. What did you make of this, Barry?
You know, the Newcastle goal was, the defenders were standing so far apart, you know. And you can only assume they have been told not to stand that far apart. You know, there is only so much a manager and his coaching staff can do. You know, Dejan Lovren does seem to be playing in through a lot of discomfort. And while I'm no doctor, I would question the wisdom of forcing someone onto the field if they're in such bad shape that they have to take all those painkillers. I don't think he said what kind of painkillers they were.
Strong ones.
But, you know, yeah, the Josselu finish was just brilliant.
He needed that, though, didn't he, with missing so many open goals. Well, he just needed one of those. When you say you need one to come off your elbow or your bum or your whatever to get you going, hopefully that's it for him.
Crystal Palace must be so jealous of him.
Lars.
Former Fulham captain Brede Hangeland wrote a piece in the Norwegian press about Liverpool's defensive woes, and he is of course a man who knows something about playing centre half in the Premier League, and he was making the point, and this might be the centre halves union piping up, but he was making the point that Liverpool's defenders have a lot less protection from their midfield than the other top teams. If you look at the other top sides, they tend to have two midfielders who'll stay in that area in front of the defence, whereas at Liverpool it's mainly Henderson. I mean, against Newcastle you have a midfield three of Coutinho, Henderson and Wijnaldum. That's really forward minded. And if you look at the goal specifically, like, Shelvey has a lot of space. It's a great pass. The defence should step up, okay, but he has an awful lot of space to pick and make that pass. And when you look at that goal again, you tend to feel that against Spurs or Chelsea or United, Shelvey would have gotten barged over by Wanyama or Matic or something before he even makes that pass. So they have, it's part of the way they've set up Liverpool that makes them a little bit easier to attack than the other teams.
And this is why Klopp is taking so much criticism, not just the defenders, because of the way they're set up. And I can't help but wondering what would happen if James Milner was put in front of that back four. I know they have a system of pressing higher the pitch, and supposedly that's tailed off a little bit recently. But if they had that kind of protection of somebody who is so disciplined, he's still only 31, James Milner. king of his, queen of his appreciation society, by the way. I think he's underrated for what he does. But I do think if they had somebody like him in that screening the back four, it would make the defenders so much more confident in what they're doing, and the goalkeeper as well, and also the attacking players. I think it would instill confidence into them, knowing that they have that protection behind them if they were to lose the ball or something were to go wrong in midfield.
Is there anyone else that you're in charge of the Appreciation Society? Justin Milner? I represent quite often Jay Rodriguez, who I think...
Yes.
It might... I've seen touches of Kane around Rodriguez, and that's maybe a step too far, but I'd like to... you know, nominate myself to represent Jay Rodriguez.
He's a really good signing for Albion. It went really under the radar, £12-13 million. I still think he'll score plenty of goals for them.
I think the Daniel Sturridge Appreciation Society numbers appear to be dwindling after his performance yesterday. It was very poor display. He just looks a shadow of the player he was or could have been. And, you know, I think injuries have taken their toll, and I think we've seen the best of him some time ago. It's kind of sad.
Yeah, great finisher. I trained with him at Bolton once. He was better than me. Okay. I'll give you that. Right, well, look, crisis. Is it crisis at Liverpool? Not yet. We're not going crisis yet.
I think because they're such a big club, it feels that way, doesn't it?
On the other side of the park,
exactly.
I think is where the crisis
and
is.
That's where we'll begin part two. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. If you remember, way back at the end of part one, we briefly touched on Everton, and this is where we're going to talk about them in detail. They lost at home to Burnley. Burnley's away record this season is frankly ridiculous. If you'd looked at the start of the season to say they'd still be unbeaten with trips to Chelsea, Spurs, Liverpool and Everton.
Particularly considering their away record last season.
Exactly. People would have laughed at you. But look, well done to Burnley. But what's going on? What is going on, Lars? What's happening?
A lot of things are happening, but one of the things I was looking forward to with Everton this season was to find out what exactly is the plan with all these number 10s. Like, because you've signed Davy Klaassen for quite a lot of money, you've signed Sigurdsson for an extraordinary amount of money, and you've committed to paying Wayne Rooney quite a lot of money. And these are all three players who tend to enjoy spending time in the same area of the pitch. I naively assumed that a professionally run institution like Everton would not just chuck millions around without having a well thought through plan for how all these guys will fit into a tactical setup. But I think it's fair to say that so far in the season we've not got a good answer to what that plan is.
Do you think they basically, because they've been going for Sigurdsson for so long, that they kept signing other ones and they thought, well, we've got to carry, you know, we can't pull out now. That would just be a bit rude, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a bit like, if I wanted to upgrade my wardrobe and I think, right, I'm going to go on a shopping trip and I'm prepared to throw a bit of money at this because I really need to get some new stuff. And I went out and I thought, I love that top. And I thought, I love that top. I love that. Love that top. Love that. I'll get that skirt. Oh, that's great. That dress. And I really love those heels. And then you get them home and realise you can't actually wear anything with them because nothing in your wardrobe matches any of it. And it feels like that's what Ronald Koeman and Everton have done in this transfer window.
Well, actually, to take that analogy further, what he really needed was some pants and he didn't get any. So, like, you've got everything else. But
a bouncy castle instead.
Exactly, and I've got no underwear to go with it all. But that's what it feels like. They spent this extraordinary amount of money, and the Everton supporters, as I mentioned on the last pod, were very excited when we were up there for the first Europa League qualifying match of the season back in July. So excited with all these new players, and I think they thought they were going to score loads of goals. Davy Klaassen's come from the Dutch league. Okay, no guarantees there, but he scored 20 goals last season from midfield, and they knew they were still after Sigurdsson, and Rooney was coming home. But at that point, of course, they still anticipated signing a striker. And the fact they didn't get Olivier Giroud, it all seemed to fall apart on that basis. Presumably, they were going for more players. And I remember on transfer deadline day, going to bed thinking, I really want to know whether Everton signed a striker. And Wolves, because they also only had one centre forward. And I thought, surely they're not going to go through the end of the transfer window like that, because it means that they haven't had a great transfer window after all. And I woke up the next morning, and sure enough, they hadn't. And they look thoroughly disjointed, and the manager's talking about how happy he is with their attitude and this and that, but you see them dropping deeper and deeper in central defence, and Ashley Williams doesn't look sure of himself at all in an Everton shirt. He's fine for Wales, and that lack of confidence is permeating through the side because they're so unbalanced.
But if you don't have pace, then it doesn't matter how good you are as a number 10, you don't have the person making the run in space to receive the pass.
Absolutely, and the Sigurdsson thing is baffling because Sigurdsson has been great for Swansea when he's played as a number 10 with the team, largely like not built around him, but he is the focal point, like he's the guy you look for. Whereas when he went to Spurs, he was kind of in and out on the team and he was moved around a little bit and he couldn't get into a rhythm and he didn't play very well. And he's gone back to Swansea, again been amazing with the team sort of focused on him. And Everton have signed him, and they look like they're doing exactly the same thing Spurs did, is that they're using him out wide, and it's not like, it's really weird if you're investing that sum of money, especially when you're Everton and you're investing that sum of money, because you've not got it lying at the back of the couch, you know, there's a big sum of money for Everton to use, and you surely must have a plan. You don't commit to spending that sort of resource without having a tactical plan for how the team's going to look this year with him at the centre of it, but it looks like they have, and that's weird.
Again, Morgan Schneiderlin as well is another person who appears, he's gone into the Snodgrass vortex, another of those players who appears to have just forgotten how to play football upon, you know, having started so well at Southampton. But yeah, it's baffling, but you know, Lukaku's goals were always going to be very hard to replace, but yeah, to have made so little effort to replace them, and after a bright start, you know, we were lauding Wayne Rooney after a couple of games, but looks like it isn't going to work out too well.
Burnley's goal had Ireland all over it, according to one radio broadcast. Stephen Ward to Jeff Hendrick, 24 passes.
And Robbie Brady with a fabulous crossfield ball as well.
Very Irish there.
Very Irish, and yet not very Irish at all, I would suggest.
Like Lars.
I've got some Burnley stats, if we go, because I've looked this up, and they're such a weird team, because they've done fabulously well, like you say. Got some great results away from home. But if you, and of course, the goal is the passage of play that ends up on Match of the Day, so it looks like they're playing very well as well. But if you look at the numbers, like they've allowed more shots against them than any team in the Premier League, and also any team in the top five European leagues. Like, we've talked, these sort of terrible teams that are in Serie A this season who are so bad, like they're skewing the... Even they don't allow as many shots against them as
Does
Burnley say do.
From how far out?
Because
Burnley would say, hey, if you score from 30 yards, that's fine.
It is true, something like 53% of them are from outside of the box, so that's a higher percentage than usual. But still, they can be gotten at. And also, only Swansea in the Premier League produce fewer shots on average, and only Swansea and Hertha Berlin in the top five European leagues produce fewer shots than Burnley do. They hit more inaccurate long balls than any other team in the Premier League. Only Leganés and Eibar are worse in the European leagues. They hit more clearances than any other team in Europe. Intriguingly, the top nine in Europe are all Premier League teams in that category. We do love a clearance in this country.
Like an inaccurate long ball. Oh, yeah, that's like a glorious
it's
thing.
Like seven games is a really small sample size. But the numbers, these numbers were very similar last year when they were sorry, 4 points away from getting relegated. And you kind of wonder how long you can actually go on like whacking the ball away at every opportunity and allowing the opponent to shoot at you 20 times and somehow win games. Like I'm not saying it definitely won't work. I'm just saying
Deitch out.
I'm really intrigued to see how the next couple of months will pan out.
Picks the day after their best performance in about three seasons to absolutely tear them a new
one. I'm just saying I'm intrigued by the fact that this is working, because if you're looking at the numbers, it shouldn't be working.
Burnley.
And I cannot believe that Burnley have just been given that amount of airtime and it's all negative. It's unbelievable.
I would like to totally disassociate myself from any negativity. I can see what's going to happen.
I'm
here.
Not negative. I'm just confused about like the discrepancy between the numbers that say what's going on the pitch
stats,
and the points.
And then there's actually watching football matches and seeing what they're doing. I'm not sorry.
We'll see in a
couple
of months.
Sorry, but I'm not sorry.
It'll be funny if it continues this way, but there's no other club like in Europe who do anything like this. And yeah, maybe they've found like a unique new way of playing football.
Praise them for the way they're so well drilled, so organised. They've got a defender in Tarkowski.
But what he's saying is the stats show that they're not that well organised. Well, like conceding all these shots.
It's definitely true that they're incredibly hard to break down, which is why teams take a lot of shots from outside the box, because you just give up trying to carve them open and you just whack it from 20 yards and those shots tend not to go in. But it's still really weird that their numbers don't correspond with any other team in Europe, and it certainly don't correspond with where they are on the table. And I'm not saying they're terrible, I'm saying they're strange, and I'm really looking forward to see if this can be kept up.
They've just played Chelsea, Tottenham, Liverpool and Everton away. They've won two and drawn two, and you're hammering them.
Would anybody like a quote from Farhad Mashiri, who is basically spends all his time on the phone to Jim White, as far as I know. So Jim tweeted this a few moments ago. "We're in a bad moment," this is Mashiri saying, "but we have played the four title contenders, three away. Today was the only unexpected loss. The four pre-qualifying UEFA games and two group games on Thursdays haven't helped. There is mental and physical fatigue and seven injuries. These are early days and Koeman has my total support. We have great fans. They deserve better. We know the honest and objective expectations of our supporters and will not let them down." So vote of confidence there for Ronald. He'll probably be sacked about an hour after we finish recording the pod, as happened to Carlo Ancelotti last week.
We'll get onto that a bit. Just one thing about Ronald Koeman. I was talking to somebody recently who is very close to the dressing room there, and I asked what he was like as a bloke, as a manager. I said, is he the sort of
Tony Hibbert at a beef eater?
With the lead piping.
No, and apparently he's not sort of, well, this is probably not a big surprise, chatty kind of chap who might ask you about your family or if you just, wife's given birth, you know, how's she doing? He's not interested particularly in players on a personal level. And he's not particularly an arm around the shoulder kind of bloke. So very interested, given their current situation, about his man management. What is that like?
He had his arm around the shoulder of David Platt, and I will never forgive him for that. West Ham 1, Swansea 0. You were there, Jackie. God, you picked a good one.
Oh, do you know what? It was brilliant. Added time was absolutely brilliant. No, it was painful. It was like pulling teeth. The atmosphere was bad. I know West Ham fans are going to be listening to this going, yeah, that's because the players are absolutely useless. And actually, they're not useless. It's the system. It's this and that. When we saw the team sheet, we're actually quite enthused about the game, bearing in mind that Bilic had gone 4-4-2, and it was the first time that Hernandez and Carroll would be playing in a two up front rather than Hernandez wide of a three. But they just didn't play as a partnership at all. There were wide open spaces between the pair of them. The midfield didn't function with Koyate and Noble. The pitch seems enormous, and that's not an excuse, but they're not covering it well. There's no cohesion. There's no sense of a system, a pattern of play. And both sides, final ball in the box was absolutely woeful, particularly from Swansea. They'd have been out of sight by half time had they actually had a final ball. But I think the manager deserves credit for his substitution. Hernandez came off and the manager was booed for that. But the two subs that he brought on then combined to conjure up a winner. And not too impressed by Sacco's goal celebration when he scored in the 90th minute, took off his shirt and then held up his name to the cameraman in front of him as if to say, look, this is about me. I wanted to leave. They wouldn't let me leave. I should be playing. I just scored a goal. This is why I should be playing. It's not about you, mate. It's about West Ham. It's about the club and it's about them trying to kickstart their season.
There is something weird about, yes, holding up your own name and waving it around, isn't there? Anyone have anything to add to West Ham Swansea?
I think Jackie's just about covered it.
Arsenal 2, Brighton 0. What's interesting about Arsenal at the moment? Is it that Mesut Ozil isn't playing? Is that the most interesting thing? Is it Arsene Wenger has, you know, he's, I wouldn't say silenced his critics, but Arsenal fan TV is probably not very interesting at the moment because they're winning and they played very well at Chelsea and it was a pretty regulation victory, wasn't it, Lars?
I think we actually talked about this last time I was in that, like, Arsenal are quite good after these sort of moments of crisis when they have a couple of really bad results. All the papers go, oh, wow, they're terrible. It's all very bad. They tend to actually, like, have go on periods of just smacking a few mid-table teams and, you know, restore a bit of a good feeling about the place. And I don't think anyone's doubting Arsenal's ability to win these games. I just think they're still going to have these crises that they do regularly and they're still going to drop too many points. But they're quite good at winning winnable games at home.
Did anyone see their game in Europe, the Borisov game, and Jack Wilshere played very well and it's, you know, nice to see him back and see how far he'll go? No?
It's up to him now, isn't it, to force his way into the side. But I think the tactical changes from Wenger since that hammering against Liverpool have been telling. The fact that, well, he had to change the midfield system. He's stuck with Xhaka and Ramsey, but now one of them's dropping back when the other one's going forwards. Instead of just going, hey, let's all just pile on forwards and try and score goals, they've got a lot more discipline in the side since then, and it's working.
Stoke 2, Southampton 1. The only note I have is about Peter Crouch. I think potentially the most popular player in the Premier League. I don't know anyone who dislikes Peter Crouch. Does anybody?
Yeah, he's pretty popular, all right. He just seems like a real nice fella.
Doesn't he? Comes on, does the business.
He's doing all right for somebody who commutes from Cobham to Stoke every day. My husband spotted him on the tube reading his copy of the Metro, wearing his shorts and looking pretty happy with life. But I think Peter Crouch is incredibly likeable. He's a very good footballer as well, it should be said. But I love the way he deals with the media. He's not afraid of social media. You don't have his agent sending tweets and pictures of himself the next day saying, another good 3 points, cracking win for the lads, on now to the next one. I've got a personal aversion to that. Agents writing tweets, full stop. No, just don't bother sending anything. And just the boring, love the support today, guys. Thanks for that. Same again next week. Crouch doesn't do any of that. He's funny. He sends photographs of giraffes saying he's hanging out with a family. He's a funny bloke who is not paranoid in the media. And I do wish, minor rant coming up, that other footballers would be less paranoid, a little bit more relaxed, doing pre-match interviews with them. I understand it's difficult. They don't want to give anything away about the team. They don't want to give anything away about the tactics. But just don't be so paranoid. Just be a bit more relaxed and realise not everybody is out to get you.
But people will argue with some justification that a lot of these players have been stitched up by the media in the past, and I know the media is, you know, not one big amorphous blob and we don't all live together in the same house, but some...
Barry's on the top bunk. Sean Custis is on the bottom.
Some reporters do have, or, you know, some newspapers do have particular agendas and can be quite spiteful and have form in the field of stitching up players. So you can, to a certain extent, understand their paranoia, but you would like to think they would be clever enough to be able to distinguish who's out to get them and who isn't.
I think if you're live to the nation, that's a good time to be a little bit more relaxed when people can see exactly or hear exactly how you mean something.
I would say in their defence that some people are just quite nervous in that environment, and so it's not necessarily, you know, if you're not comfortable in that environment, that's the whole key, isn't it? Of, you know, if you're interviewing someone on air, is to get them relaxed. How you do it, there are lots of different ways, I guess.
If you've been a professional athlete since you were 13, but 14, you might not be great at writing funny tweets.
Yeah.
Whereas if you write funny tweets all the time, you might not be a great athlete.
I've sent 40,000 tweets and not many of them have been funny. Yeah. Disappointing.
I don't understand that, but sorry, just on that point, I think, and I've seen it plenty when press officers, and some of them are excellent, do a really good job, but I think there is a sense that if you're a press officer, then you need to try to tell the player to bat everything back. Don't answer that question. Just give that a straight cliched answer. And I don't think it does the player any favours.
I think it comes from the manager as well. If you talk around, I remember I was at Birmingham interviewing Gary Rowett and the press officer saying he's so good and it comes from him. So players relax in the media. If your manager is one of those managers that hates any sort of intrusion, and then you're a player who says something, you don't want to get in trouble with the manager. The press officer is also nervous about how something happens and he'll get in trouble with the manager. So if the manager isn't relaxed or isn't that way inclined, that could affect things. I would love to see a map of all the commuting footballers. You know, if anyone's not busy, could just do a little car with Peter Crouch's. He's getting the train, is he, from Cobham to Stoke?
Yeah.
Harry was going from what, Bournemouth to Birmingham?
Rafa goes from the Wirral, is it, to Newcastle?
It's just a lovely... Did I see that in a sort of pictorial video form, if someone could make it? Ricky Lambert's just retired, I've just been told. Did very well at Southampton, didn't quite work out for him at Liverpool. It would have been nice, wouldn't it? Because he seems... Speaking of genuinely appear like nice blokes, where was he? I think he was a free agent, wasn't he?
But he'd been linked with Crystal Palace, which is probably what finished him off.
He was at Cardiff last season.
All about.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Scored in his England debut, had a good career. And it was one of those that worked his way up from the lower league. And again, it was a really nice story of a lad just working really, really hard, getting his way to the top and taking his opportunity when it came. Well, they had a really good career.
West Brom, another of his former clubs, drew 2-2 with Watford. It was lovely to see Aurelio Gomez up for that free kick in the last minute.
Yes.
Wasn't it? And I didn't see if he joined in the celebrations because the camera cut away, or did he sprint back to his goal at the end? That was what I wanted to see. I like to see how slow goalkeepers are.
He might have done both. He might have celebrated on his way back, like doing cartwheels and things. That feels like a very Gomez thing to do. No, it was good. And Richarlison looks very good. And Watford will be fine. It's Marco Silva doing well. And it's interesting to see the sort of Pozzo family, the famous scouting network of the Pozzo family, kind of coming into effect a little bit with the Brazilian guy, Richarlison, because they're very famous for that around Europe, like their ability to find good talented players for Udinese and stuff. And we haven't really seen that so much at Watford yet.
I think he was a silver signing, wasn't he? He knew about him at Fluminense, signing for 13 million.
I'm guessing the Pozzo family scouts were probably also aware of him. This is my theory, but
he's doing really well, Marco Silva, and he's got everybody purring about his abilities, and he's got the clubs in the Premier League, the fans of the lower reaching clubs, saying, I wish we'd have got Marco Silva, because as soon as he got to Hull, I think after even a few games, I spoke to somebody senior at Hull who was saying he really is I'll tell you who after saying his attention to detail is phenomenal, and whether Hull go down or stay up, they said there's no way he'll still be there.
Bournemouth 0, Leicester 0, well done to both of you. In the Football League, Cardiff City, am I going to get stick with that, Barry? In the Football League, Cardiff stays top of the Championship after playing in the only goalless draw of the weekend with Derby. Wolves spank Burton 4-0 away. Finbar says, does Jackie think Wolves are automatic promotion material?
Contenders, certainly, yeah. Despite only having one senior, although he's still quite junior, centre-forward, they've now got Helder Costa back, played at the weekend without a recognised centre-forward, and those at the game were purring about the interchanging of passing, the fantastic tactical awareness of the manager, Nuno. The players have all bought into his philosophy and his tactics, and touch wood, it's all going well.
Hull beat Birmingham 6-1. New boss Steve Cotterill watched from the stands. Apparently he went to the dressing room afterwards and told the players the season starts on Monday. So that's good news for Birmingham. Leeds suffered their third defeat in four. They slipped to fifth. They've been overtaken by Bristol City, who won 3-1 at Ipswich. The City manager Lee Johnson has said of their goal celebration gifts, which you haven't seen yet, are tremendous. Quote, it can have a benefit because the lads might just 1% more get into areas because they're thinking they can have a little bit of fun watching their gif back. Bolton are still bottom, suffering their worst start to a league season since 1902. No goals in the last seven games. 7 points off safety. In League One, the top two stayed the same. Leaders Shrewsbury beat Scunthorpe 2-0. The only undefeated team out of the 72 below the Premier League. Wigan stay 4 points behind them thanks to a 2-0 win over Walsall. Plymouth stay bottom after losing to Bristol Rovers away. Billy Bowden scoring his sixth of the season. After the game, Plymouth's Twitter said, thanks, brackets, most of you, close brackets, for your company. Keep it here for all the reaction and keep it green. Hashtag PAFC biting at some of the abuse they're getting. Plymouth have as many red cards as points in their first 11 games, 5. In League 2, Notts County lost to Mansfield 2-1, so extra on level on points with them after they beat Morecambe 4-1. Forest Green Rovers suffered their 8th defeat of the season, losing 1-0 at home to Accrington Stanley. And we lost at Swindon. Sad for me. Right, that's the end of part two. In part three, we'll begin with politics in Spain. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. Let's go to Spain. Sid Lowe is there. Sid, how are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, very well. Strange weekend. I mean, people don't necessarily come to this podcast for political chat, but it, you know, spilled into football, didn't it? The Nou Camp was empty. Gerard Piqué's offered to step aside from the Spanish national team if his support of the independence of Catalonia is a problem. How's it been?
Well, I mean, you said it in a way, very strange. I mean, the sport and politics. There's this line that's always said in Spain that sports and politics shouldn't mix, but they do mix. There's no real way around that. And clubs, when they've tried to avoid politics, have effectively kind of done politics by a different name. But of course, with Barcelona, it's much, much more explicit. And Barcelona's identification with Catalan, I suppose it sort of depends, because over periods in history, it fluctuates. It's not always as clear cut whether it's a direct identification with Catalan politics or with Catalan society, but always identification is with Catalan, with Catalonia rather than with Spain. And obviously this weekend with the independence referendum, which of course has been declared legal by the constitutional courts and by the Spanish government, that all came to a head when there was violence on Sunday morning. And Barcelona, who'd backed the right to vote, and it's kind of an important refining of the argument is that it's not necessarily support for independence, it's support for the right to vote for independence. It's seen as, or at least it's been projected by Barcelona as you know, support for the democratic right to vote rather than necessarily to say, right, we want to leave Spain. And then the violence on Sunday morning provoked a situation in which Barcelona felt that they wanted to make some sort of stand. They wanted to postpone the game because they felt that with the violence that, that had been seen, they couldn't play. But the league told them that they weren't allowed to. They told them that they would lose the game 3-0 and have a further 3 points taken off them. They were told that this wasn't a security issue, that the police could guarantee the security in the stadium, although whether or not that's genuinely the case, I must admit I have my doubts. And so Barcelona took this kind of slightly yes but no decision to say, all right, well, we'll play, but we'll play without fans as a way of sending an image around the world that everyone can see of us in an empty stadium. And I suppose on that level, it works. Whether it was the right thing to do, I'm not so sure, because, of course, it annoys the fans that don't get in and can't see it. And for those fans who wanted a more determined stance, a more direct protest, those fans say, well, this isn't enough. You should have said, no, we're just not playing. And if we have to lose 6 points because of it, well, we'll lose 6 points because this cause is greater than that. So I suppose, in a way, you could almost say, ultimately, the sport did win out over the politics.
Yeah, a difficult position from them as well. Real Madrid, did they... Cause, I mean, I presume, you know, Madrid is the seat of government, and I don't know how they see it over there, but they were all waving Spanish flags in support of that, were they?
Yeah, I mean, again, and there's different layers to this, and I think this is one of the reasons why this is so complex, and one of the reasons why, and for example, lots of people, you know, sort of want to know with Piqué, the assumption is that he's pro-independence, and to be honest with you, my assumption for a very long time has been he probably would vote no, although I suspect he would now vote yes. But he was certainly in favour of what's been described in Catalonia as the right to decide. But I think there are different layers of it. Obviously, there's a layer which is, number one, whether you accept any possibility of independence. Number two, whether you accept the right to vote for independence, even if you don't support independence in any way. And then the third level, which was added to this yesterday, was the nature of the state intervention to reinforce that this referendum wouldn't take place. Now, of course, the Spanish state are saying that, well, this is just us enforcing the law, and the only people responsible are the people who brought the referendum in the first place. But the imagery yesterday and the photographs and the videos are really, really unpleasant, and so of course that's created a sense in, and you know, there were protests last night in Madrid, in the centre of Madrid, supporting Catalans, not necessarily supporting their right to independence or even necessarily supporting their right to vote on it, but certainly supporting their right not to be the victims of violence as a result of it, or at least not to be put in that kind of situation. Now at the Bernabeu, where, as you say, there were chants of Viva España in the 12th minute and lots of Spain flags. Now again, that's another thing that I think is quite difficult, because you don't know which of those three levels that's being expressed on. Is that being expressed on saying essentially we essentially embrace the idea that there's been violence and that there's been police, heavy policing to prevent you from voting, or is it just saying no, we're expressing the idea of a unified Spain, which doesn't necessarily express support for the kind of really quite frightening scenes that we saw throughout the course of the day. That said, of course, the timing of it does kind of imply that, doesn't it? Even if inadvertently, even if that's not the intention. I must admit, in all of this, I'm genuinely not sure kind of where all this falls down, except that there is a bottom line, which is yesterday the footage yesterday was really, really scary, and that footage was really deeply and deeply unpleasant, and that has, of course, even if you look at it purely in terms of the Spanish state, is massively counterproductive as well.
Sid, you speak of that upsetting footage which we've all seen, and I noticed Las Palmas had Spanish flags embroidered into their shirts deliberately for this fixture. Is that irresponsible and deliberately inflammatory, or not much of a big deal?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know how you sort of intuitively feel about this. My sort of immediate response was to think, well, you know, if you are a football team, as some football teams in Spain do, that always have a Spain flag on your shirt, then you turn up with your Spain flag always on your shirt. In a moment like this, I suppose, looked at from within a Catalan context, it can be seen as inflammatory. But I suppose their point of view is, well, why should everyone else have the right? Well, why should Barcelona in this case have the right to support a vote on an independence that we don't agree with, and us not have the right to wear a Spain flag? I suppose I don't know really intuitively where I sit on that, but certainly in Catalonia, I think it was seen as kind of unnecessarily provocative. I mean, I think more than anything else, it was seen as unnecessary rather than necessarily, you know, rather than as kind of by definition nasty.
To the football, easy win for Barcelona, wasn't it really?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't play very well in the first half, and you know, they said after the game it was a very strange environment to play in, and it's quite difficult to perform in that sort of situation. It was a very strange experience to be in the stadium, and to hear, you know, to hear it almost like a park game on a Sunday, and in a way it's quite comforting to hear that they say the same sort of largely meaningless stuff that we say when we play, you know, lots of shouts of man on and time, and you know, there's also something quite odd about I mean, I know it shouldn't be odd, but it's something quite odd about hearing people shout, Leo, over here, Leo.
I love the thought of Messi after going 1-0 up going, come on, next five, nothing silly, lads, still 0-0.
Yeah, go, come on, nothing's changed, it's still 0-0, lads, still 0-0. And there was sort of an element of that, and there was a couple of choice moments of choice repartee from Luis Suarez as well. And it was a very curious thing. The other thing that kind of was really noticeable is the sound of football that you don't normally get. And genuinely, there were moments of the game where you felt like you could close your eyes and you could sense the way the game was going, or at least what kind of passing was going on by the difference in the noise. Because, you know, most of the passing, they genuinely put in their foot through it. And they, you know, even passes are hit pretty hard. But there's a difference between a kind of a thump and a tack sort of noise. And the kind of the short, tight passing, you can it really sounds different. And it was a very bizarre experience. And, you know, when Messi scores, I think it's the second, maybe it's the third goal, there's a little smattering of applause, and it's a ball boy behind the goal who's clapping him. But there's, you know, there's virtually nothing else. The other weird thing, of course, was then coming onto the pitch for the sound of the Barcelona anthem, which is a bit bizarre in an empty stadium, and even more bizarre because the opening line of the Barcelona anthem says the whole stadium is cheering loudly.
Bizarre. Elsewhere, anything of note, Zid?
Well, it's a weekend of crazy results, and here's one for you. Real Sociedad had conceded 3 goals 4 games in a row, and they finally managed to break that run this weekend by conceding 4.
Yeah, amazing game, and scored 4.
Yeah. I mean, them and Betis are definitely teams that are worth watching at the moment.
Sid, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Sid Lowe out in Spain. Very interesting stuff there. Fascinating to hear about them playing and just hearing the way they kick the ball. It's a very good point he makes.
It's like being at reserve matches, isn't it?
Or like being at Tottenham Barnsley at Wembley in the Carabao Cup.
Or in the Arsenal game.
The list goes on. From Spain to Italy, Barry, what's going on?
Well, Juventus dropped their first points of the season, which means Napoli are now top of the table on their own, 2 points clear with 7 wins out of 7. Juve went to Atalanta, went 2 goals up, and then allowed Atalanta to steal off with a point. So a rare error from Gigi Buffon allowed Atlanta to get back in the game. And then Mario Mandzukic had a goal ruled out that would have put Juve 3-1 up. It was video refereeing playing a part in Italy again, and it's proving to be very contentious. Not so much with the Mandzukic goal. There was a Lichtensteiner elbow in the build-up, so the ref chalked it off. But after Brian Cristante had equalised, made it 2-2 for Atalanta, Juve got a late penalty for an Andrea Petagna handball, and he was standing at the end of the wall for a free kick. The ball hit him on the shoulder.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Ref gave the penalty, then consulted the video and still gave the penalty. And Juve proceeded to miss it. So justice was eventually done.
But how can he do? I mean, literally, it's unbelievable. And it's just, is it just that, you know, some referees are so pig-headed? Like, what? How can he not change his mind there?
It reminds me, if you ever said this, forgive me, there's one observer of Italian football said that VAR doesn't mean an end to the conspiracy theories, it just means more interesting conspiracy theories. And that was the kind of incident that brought that to mind.
I think both managers after the game were complaining about it, saying that it's just not working, it's too confusing and needs to be tailored or tampered with or, you know, fixed up. And that seemed to be the consensus. You know, I think a lot of people who were calling for video referees in football have changed their tunes since it was introduced in certain places. Elsewhere, AC Milan lost again, their second 2-0 defeat in a row in Serie A. and it leaves them seventh, 9 points off the pace. And reports in Italy suggest that Vincenzo Montella, their manager, will be fired if AC Milan do not beat Inter. Their next game is at the San Siro against Inter. It's Inter's home tie. So, you know, but the club's sporting director, Massimiliano Mirabelli, has given him a vote of confidence. So, like Ronald Koeman, he could be gone an hour after we finished recording the pod here. And the tonking of the week this week was came in Lazio's game against Sassuolo, where the Roman side came from a goal down to win 6-1.
Thank you very much, Barry. In Germany, Borussia Dortmund got their fourth win in a row, beating Augsburg 2-1 away from home. They've opened up a 5-point gap between them and Bayern Munich, who drew their first game post-Ancelotti. His former assistant, Willy Sanyol, was on the sidelines for this game. Has anybody interviewed Willy Sanyol? Because he came on Fantasy Football. So it's an hour-long show, Willy Sanyol, and he's a lovely man. He told a brilliant story about after the Zidane headbutt in the World Cup final, and he went up to Zidane and said, "I hate you because, you know, you've won a World Cup and I never have and I never will now." And he was fascinating. But when he speaks in English, he sounds exactly like the policeman from Hello, Hello. I mean, literally, it's unbelievable. So he was like, "Good morning." And you're like, I can't bring this up, but all I can think about is... Anyway, it was difficult. We didn't talk about Ancelotti because...
Did you talk about the fallen Madonna with the big boobies?
I wanted to. I just couldn't bring myself... Also, it would have been difficult because he might not have a clue what it was as well. So it'd be a difficult reference for him. Ancelotti's sacking, while we're on Germany. Does anybody have any strong feelings about this, Lars?
Not beyond the fact that he'll probably go off and enjoy some time off. You know, of all the managers at that level of world football, he seems to be the one who's least worried about getting sacked here and there. You know, he'll be going off to Vancouver to spend time with his Canadian wife, I'm sure. And if I'm not mistaken, I'm misremembering that. Anyway,
you made it sound like he had many wives. Yeah, he would go to his Canadian one for this one.
He's not Sven, is he? he did, of course, have a tiny cameo in the most recent Star Trek film because it was shot in Vancouver and he was there. So if you watch very closely, he is identifiable in the background in one of the scenes in Star Trek Beyond.
Oh, that's amazing.
You have to
but
freeze.
Not a speaking role.
You have to freeze at a very specific time and you can see him walking down the corridor. So I'm sure he'll have good... No,
He does have that kind of Lieutenant Worf eyebrow thing going on, doesn't he?
I think he's a doctor, I think, technically, but in that scene. I don't know. But it's worth looking out for.
I'm pleased about it.
Uh-huh. He's not the kind of manager Bayern really want, but Miguel Delaney wrote a good piece. Well, I didn't necessarily agree with all of it, but the thrust of his argument was that... Ancelotti's Champions League record compared to his record of winning leagues, domestic leagues with these big teams, just doesn't stack up, you know. And Miguel sort of argued that Champions Leagues are easier to win than domestic titles, and he's not very good at winning domestic titles, which is, you know, if you're going to be at Bayern Munich, then that's what you need to be doing all the time.
Elsewhere in Germany, Eden Hazard's brother, Thorgan, had a better day than his brother. He scored a match-winning last-minute penalty as Mönchengladbach beat Hannover 2-1. Almost every team scored this weekend. The only two who didn't played against each other, both really needed to get the win. Alas, Hamburg and Werder Bremen ended the weekend both in the bottom three. That was Germany. In France, in Ligue 1, PSG were 5-1 up at half-time. The first time they've scored 5 goals in the first half of a match. Neymar scored 2, Cavani, Mbappe, Draxler, Meunier with a goal each. It ended 6-2. Lyon suffered the weirdest red card I've seen this season. I don't know if anyone's seen this. They were 3-1 up. Their Brazilian defender, Marcelo, not that one, received a yellow for a tackle on the edge of the box. And the ref waves the yellow card at him and he sort of goes, "Oh, come on, ref," and swings his arm in the air. And as he does it, he flicks the yellow card out of the ref's hand. And the ref is basically the same sort of ref as the one doing the Juventus game and had no sort of self-awareness or anything. Just immediately produced a red card, you know, and he was like, he didn't mean to do it. Anyway, they were 3-1 up. They drew that game 3-3. Balotelli.
Remember the time Gazza?
Yeah, I was thinking exactly like that.
That was the most... oafish piece of officialdom I've ever seen. With Gazza, for anyone who may not know, the ref, he dropped his yellow card.
Yeah.
Gazza picked it up and instead of handing it straight back to him, gave the ref a yellow card, and the ref took it off him and showed it to him.
He did apologise afterwards. He realised the referee, he realised he got it wrong.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he did apologise.
Good. Credit to him. I was just about to totally slam as the most humourless human being on the planet.
Well, he did get absolutely slated for it at the time. Yeah. It's like, come on, ref.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? On my Saturday football, I know listeners are fascinated about this. It's referees who... 5 minutes into the game, this is Polytechnic Fours, the old Ignatius Fours. He makes my right wing back go off the pitch because his sock tape was not the same colour as his socks. And you're like, ref, I mean, this is not the Champions League final. Just what are you doing? Anyway, and then gave offsides from the centre circle just at will. He was quite a nice man in the bar. I'll give him some credit for that. Balotelli, did anyone see his Rabona crossfield pass? That was very nice. Nice lost 4-2 to Marseille. Marseille are third now. Monaco still second, despite being held 1-1 by Montpellier. Falcao scored his 12th of the season in Ligue 1 after just 8 games. And I thought, this is terrible if anyone saw this, for the 4 Lille fans seriously injured during their game against Amiens. Fode Ballo-Touré just scored the opening goal of the game in the 15th minute and a section of the wall from the fans collapsed. And a lot of the away fans just fell and there was a crush. The game was abandoned immediately. The Amiens president seemed to blame the fans afterwards, saying the police had warned us that 200 very worked-up ultras were in the stand reserved for Lille fans, and they threw themselves in a disorderly fashion, more than 500 people, onto this barrier, which was in a perfect state. Imagine 500 people trying to get onto the pitch. The league officials need to strongly think about travelling fans, which is doesn't seem correct, even if it is completely inopportune timing to say that when people are seriously injured. Right, feedback corner and questions time. Amardeep says, please keep feedback corner on Football Weekly and indeed as much added guff as you can. I love it. And for you, Amardeep, here we go. Juventitra says, Barry said Messi fits the bill as world class, winning trophies, etc. Who would the panel say are the worst world class players?
Christian Karambu.
No, he's a nice bloke, so you can't say that.
I'm sure he is a very nice bloke, and he's a very handsome man, and he enjoyed huge success without ever really seeming to contribute to any of that success.
Christian FM4 says, I'm keen to know if anyone is aware of Garth Crook's opinion on Antoine Griezmann's hairstyle, which is a good point, because we mentioned his hair last week, but we didn't mention the Garth Crook scale, whereby you're only allowed amazing hair or ridiculous hair if you're brilliant at football. Do we think Griezmann's ability matches his hair or not?
I mean, what?
Lars, this is Feedback Corner. This is the critical part of the show.
The premise is perfect. I think it looks a bit naff, regardless of his quality, to be honest. He used to have decent hair, now he doesn't. Mm.
Yeah, I was doing the Audi Cup coverage for ITV in the pre-season with Bayern, Liverpool, Atletico Madrid and Napoli. And the first thing the pundits, Paul Ince and Robbie Fowler, said was about Griezmann's hair. They weren't happy with it at all. Not happy. It was blonde, it was longer. What does he do? That kind of thing.
Paul Ince called himself the governor. How can he criticise anyone?
Well, he didn't have stupid hair, I guess.
But he had the governor stitched into his boots.
The real question is whether Griezmann's hair precludes him from being a centre-half in one of Garth Crooks' teams of the week.
That's a good point. Speaking of blonde strikers, Kevin Doyle, that was a sad story. You will see that he has retired with immediate effect, getting lots of headaches. And does sort of raise the question of, sort of presumed that the heading the football issue was a thing of the past, i.e. because balls used to be saturated and very heavy. And we all know what happened with Jeff Astill. And
Eric Harrison more recently, the coach, the class of 92, who've all been to go and visit him at various times and apparently been really saddened by how advanced his... Alzheimer's is. So it is sad. Daniel Taylor wrote a good column about this yesterday, and the thing about the heavy, saturated with rain balls is now the game is quicker, balls are hit lighter and go faster. So it's false. Daniel makes point it's false to say that they're safer. We don't know for sure if heading footballs causes brain damage, but studies in the United States where they've actually take this kind of thing seriously would suggest that perhaps they do.
Football's a bit new to this concussion business, isn't it? They're all still a little bit in denial, the old school, you know, the likes of John Lambie, Partick Thistle manager back in the early 90s with his famous quote of his centre-forward was concussed and the physio told him and he said, well, tell him he's Pelé and get him back on. And, you know, it's all very funny and that's how we see footballers being, just getting back on. Well, he's all right. He's only banged to the head. He'll be fine. Of course he'll play again on Saturday. We need him. He's our best player. But rugby has woken up to this major problem of concussion and football's still a little bit slow on the uptake. But obviously further studies need to be done.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you're a jockey and you suffer a concussion, you have to go you're stood down automatically for 2 weeks and then you have to go and get it checked by a doctor, pass fit by a doctor before you're allowed back on a horse. And
they've tried to do it with football.
They don't take it seriously at all.
Lloris got concussed and went back on the pitch in Everton, I think. But they're trying to bring that in, aren't they? Concussion, you go off.
They have to impose it because, I know a top physio who says how much pressure they're under from managers. Like they will tell the manager there's absolutely no way he can play it. And the manager will say he's absolutely playing. They don't care. They need them. Their job's on the line. He's their main player, one of the best players. That's how it is, which is why you need to have these rules or laws in place to prevent a manager from overruling club doctors.
Hmm. Anyway, all our thoughts definitely with Kevin Doyle. Sad news there. Paul writes, Barry, and your reference, you were made a reference about picking up a piano and dropping it on the street if it was intent, if you didn't hit anyone or something. I can't remember. You brought up pianos and moving them. And Paul says, as a former expert in moving pianos, he can state that despite their size, a grand piano is much easier to move than your upright piano because they can be dismantled. So it's important that everyone listening knows that. Declan says, is Max the voiceover for a certain indigestion remedy? AC Jimbo used to sell out with much more class. All I can say is Gaviscon soothes in under 3 minutes and lasts for up to 4 hours.
Well, I think AC Jimbo sold out to McDonald's. He took the Mac Shekel. I'd say Gaviscon is slightly less shameful.
Well, that's
still
it.
Shameful.
Hey, no, you have the McDonald's. That's what Jimbo sells. Then I come along and you feel better afterwards. And finally, I don't know if you know this, but the future Mrs. Rushton had a small role to play on the podcast last week because we apologised for Ancelotti, not mentioning Ancelotti because it had happened after we'd finished recording. So I recorded a little bit when walking in the park with the future Mrs. Rushton. And so I went to her for breaking news and her question was, is Bayern Munich a football club? To which the wise says, with knowledge like that, your wife could host the pod next time you're away skiing. we will make that happen. Barry, thanks for your time.
And you.
Thank you, Lars. Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Thursday. International break. They're the best ones. Hi, everybody. You thought we'd finished, but we haven't, because I forgot to do three things. Barry, I forgot Fitbar with you. Lars, I forgot Norway with you. And Jackie, I forgot Man City's new star, Nadia Nadim. So we'll do Fitbar Corner first.
Right, well, I'll try and keep it short. Celtic came within 10 minutes of ending their domestic unbeaten run of 27,000 years. They could only draw with Hibs, but they came from behind to get a 2-2 draw. I think the big story in Scotland at the moment is the ongoing, never less than entertaining soap opera at Rangers, where Kenny Miller, club legend and talisman, albeit slightly aging and not quite as good as he once used to be, has been banished to play with the kids by Pedro Cascina. After Rangers lost against Celtic in the Old Firm derby, there was sort of a crisis meeting at the training ground and Cascina tore into the home-based Rangers players saying they hadn't welcomed him or his backroom staff or any of the foreign signings to the club. He also tore into Graham Dorans, who was captain in the game against Celtic. And when Kelly Miller was brought on as Rangers were trying to claw back a 1-0 lead, Dorans threw him the captain's armband without being told to. And Cascina accused him of trying to undermine his authority. So Miller, on Sunday afternoon, played for the Rangers kids against Brentford development team.
Under 10s, under 15s?
Something like that, yeah. And apparently you know, there was no trace of a sulk. He gave his all. He was supposed to have been very encouraging and, you know, helping out the youngsters around him on the field. And there's also been a bit of a palaver. I think the story of the training ground bust-up ended up in the Daily Record. I think there was talk that people were accusing Kenny Miller of being the source of the leak. And the Daily Record have said that he is emphatically not the source of the leak, and Rangers management should, or, you know, the powers that be at the club should perhaps look closer to home. Oh. So it's this one will run and run, but I would say Pedro Caixinha's days are numbered, because these things tend to only ever end one way. And perhaps the most damning thing of all is that, you know, as good a pro as he was for three spells at Rangers, Kenny Miller is 37. He's not the player he used to be, and he's still being held up as this incredibly important figure at the club, and will probably win this PR battle because of his popularity. And he is, by all accounts, a model professional and a very good guy.
From Fitbar Corner to Norway Corner. Lars.
I'll make it even shorter. Rosenborg are winning the league, as they tend to do. Last moment for them to maybe slip up and have a spectacular collapse was probably this weekend, where they played second in the league, Sarpsborg, a team who are punching well above their weight and doing really rather well, all things considered. It ended up being a draw, which means Rosenborg are 9 points ahead with like six games left or something like that, which means they are going to win again. There was also a clash of the former Premier League players when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Molde met Eirik Bakke's Sogndal. You'll be delighted to know that Eirik Bakke's Sogndal is exactly what you expect a team managed by Eirik Bakke to be. They're a very, very scrappy bunch indeed. But you know, God bless him, he's gone back to his hometown club. They're from Sogndal. It's a very small place. They don't have a lot of resources. They have to make the most out of absolutely everything, and he's really doing that. He looks like he's on course to keep them up through... Go for it.
Oh, no, I thought you were finished. I was going to... Did Nick Bentner... like pull off some sensational 30-yard backheel?
Yes,
or something.
We should have gotten to that on Rosenborg. This is a very bad Norwegian football corner. But no, just Eirik Bakke is turning into a very decent manager, I'd have to say. He's got a scrappy team that fights for every ball and all of this. They held Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's much more fancied Molde to a 2-2 draw at the weekend. A good point for Sogndal there. Molde are finishing third, which is a bit of a meh season for them, but they've also had quite a lot of player turnover there. Their squad doesn't really make sense, and I think Solskjaer will have another chance to go again next year. You are right, Barry. Nicholas Bentner had a sort of a Zlatan light moment, as he does now and again in the Europa League last week. It's well worth looking up on the internet. He played a backheeled through ball to the right back, who was for some reason on the left side of the penalty box in there, and played him through on goal. It's really worth checking out. He has done a few of these things, Bentner. He does spend quite a lot of time just larking about, but he does also produce moments of genuine quality, the likes of which Norwegian clubs generally don't produce. He scored quite a lot of goals. He's on track to become top scorer. So the Bentner experience has worked pretty well. Lastly, Lars Bohinen, a former Nottingham Forest and Blackburn favourite, Lars Bohinen, is doing tremendously well. His team Sandefjord were newly promoted this season. I think every single expert expected them to go down. I think it was one of those teams everyone thought would go straight back down. They are eighth. They're playing a sort of three at the back system that teams are finding very hard to work out. So again, appropriately for Lars Bohinen, and a man who had a lot of nous on the pitch, is showing quite a lot of nous off it.
Thank you very much. I thought that was an excellent Norwegian corner. Jackie, finally, this Danish star that Man City have signed, Nadia Nadim. Fascinating story about her. Give us some background.
Yeah, extraordinary background. She was born and brought up in Afghanistan. At the age of 10, her father, who was in the Afghan army, was taken out into the desert by the Taliban and executed. And her mum and her four sisters didn't know anything about it for another 6 months. And she was brought up with the football that she had, that her dad had given her, but they weren't allowed to play football in public as such. Girls... women weren't seen in public playing sport. She never had any sporting role models at all of a female persuasion. And so she just had to play football in the back garden. And then at the age of 12, they managed to escape from Afghanistan and ended up via a bus and via Pakistan in Denmark. They were in the back of a bus. They were dropped off somewhere. They had absolutely no idea where they were, having got forged passports to get that far. And they had to ask somebody on the side of the road, where are we? they were in Denmark, and then she ended up in an asylum hostel. Her mum ended up getting several jobs to try to pay for the five daughters' upbringing, and she joined a football club, but she couldn't keep going because she couldn't afford the fare there, so the club had to pay for her bus fare to get there every week. And then she became a fully fledged Denmark international and reached the Euro 2017 final this year. Now she's just signed for Manchester City. So when we say a player has an interesting background, usually we say it if they've played for more than six clubs or something, but actually in Nadia Nadim's case, she really, really has.
And she's a medical student.
Training
to be a doctor?
Yeah, speaks nine languages or something. Set up a charity already, sort of helping, you know, people in similar positions. So yeah, pretty remarkable person.
There are a lot of women's players who have fascinating backgrounds. It's just that media don't ask the questions of them, but there are so many players. I mean, we know about Farrah Williams, who's now at Reading, England record cap holder, who used to be homeless and carried on playing for England when she was homeless, because she didn't tell anybody about it. She didn't want any sympathy or any help. She just managed to plough through it. There are so many women's stories with interesting backgrounds, but Manchester City, where Nadia Nadim plays for, beat Arsenal 5-2 at the weekend in the WSL, which was a big, big result for them, and a very bad result for Arsenal. Chelsea winning 6-0 at Sunderland. Liverpool, we know about their problems on the men's side, but they lost 3-0 at home to Reading. And the other match was Bristol City beating Yeovil 1-0. So I think the WSL 1 will be interesting this season. Tottenham, by the way, for those who are interested in Tottenham, they got their first ever WSL win at the weekend, beating Aston Villa. That's in the second tier.
You used to play, didn't you?
I did, not at that level. I didn't start until I went to university. There were no clubs near me, and I wasn't allowed to play at school. But yeah, I got quite a nasty knee injury. I was on crutches for 10 months, which is why I changed career to be a sport journalist, because I couldn't bear to not go to football or play football every week.
Well, thank you very much again, everybody, for your time. This is the second time we say goodbye, and we really have to go because I've got to move my car. So see you on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.